Welcome to the Plain Label Podcast, Pod Shots.
Have you ever wondered what would happen if all the great thinkers decided to get together and actually change the world for the better? And the result was, well, miracles. Who are you? I'm the future. They're coming.
She's full of surprises.
We have to go!
That place I saw, it exists?
Of course it does. But if you didn't come with me, it went for much longer. Dreamers need to stick together.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Podshots. I'm your host, Eric Williams. For this episode, we are talking about the 2015 film Tomorrowland. The film was written mostly by Damon Lindelof and directed by Brad Bird and stars George Clooney, Britt Robertson, and Hugh Laurie. Here to discuss the film with me is my Lindelof and Disney disciple, Mr. Sean Stangland.
Hello, everyone.
Before getting into our discussion, I would like to mention that this podcast is brought to you by the Deliberate Noise Network. Head over to deliberatenoise.com and check out some of the other shows that are over there. And I should also mention that Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial membership. Just go to audibletrial.com/plainlabelpodcast and choose from over 180,000 audio programs. Download a title free and start listening. It's just that easy. Go to audibletrial.com/plainlabelpodcast and get started today. Okay, Mr. Stangland, let's get a little drink roll call going. What are you having beverage-wise?
All right, I am drinking from Kansas City, Missouri's Boulevard Brewing, a Tank 7 Farmhouse Ale, which is one of the top-rated farmhouse/saisons in the country. And it's actually themed to this movie, which is somewhat tied to theme parks, in that I first had this beer sharing it with my dad at the Scat Cats Club at Port Orleans French Quarter Resort at Walt Disney World.
Wow. That is the good stuff.
So there you go.
I know the Boulevard Brewing Company quite well, seeing as though they're just a short drive from where we are currently recording, or where I'm currently recording. I cannot say that I've ever had that, though.
So it's pretty spectacular. I'd rank it right up there with Hennepin from Oligong, which is probably my favorite beer of the moment.
And you're a big Saison guy these days, right?
Yeah, it kind of creeped up on me where all of a sudden that's what I like to drink. But a little Saison, a little IPA. I like some heavy flavor in my beer now, apparently.
Well, there you go. It's your old age is what it is.
Carnation.
I need the flavor. I can't taste it otherwise.
I had a Miller Lite a few weeks ago, and it was like, I was like, I used to drink this? And I felt like such a snob.
Oh,
I feel awful even just saying that.
I feel like that every time I watch any kind of movie. what a snob I've become. I'm having a futuristic brew. It tastes like an alcoholic piece of candy. it's not really that futuristic, but I'm having a Red Bull vodka.
There you go.
So that's what you have at night to keep
you're
you
not having your special shake to keep you young.
I'm not. No.
Okay.
Just the Red Bull vodkas. That's it. Okay. So let's go ahead and kick off our discussion of the 2015 film Tomorrowland.
Every second that ticks by,
the future is running out.
Newton?
That's not mine.
What's not yours?
The pen. I've never...
What if there was a place?
Dad, I just need you to look at this. Does it look weird?
A secret place. Where nothing was impossible.
You're not
saying this! Casey, stop it!
Go away! Did you see the dog?
Cool. I want you to take me there.
Take you where?
Where'd you get this? Who are you, kid?
What you saw was a place where the best and the brightest people of the world came together to actually change it. We've been looking for someone like you for a very long time.
Why? Did something happen over there? Something bad?
They followed you here?
Who?
Come on! Get in!
How is this a good idea?
There's one way in. They know we're coming, so follow me.
All the people, why me?
He thinks you can fix the future.
Hang on!
You wanted to see Tomorrowland. Here it comes.
And the IMDb plot synopsis, man alive, it goes like this. Bound by a shared destiny, a bright, optimistic teen bursting with scientific curiosity and a former boy genius inventor jaded by disillusionment embark on a danger-filled mission to unearth the secrets of an enigmatic place somewhere in time and space that exists in their collective memory as Tomorrowland. Okay, so... before getting into the discussion and your specific history with this movie before when it was called something other than Tomorrowland.
That's right.
Let me ask you this, and this is sort of the question that I've been answering in the close to a week or so since I've seen this. What is this movie about, Sean? Because that's the overwhelming question is people are like, oh yeah, you went and saw Tomorrowland? What is that? What is that movie?
I've been asked this question a lot, and I did craft a somewhat truncated version to tell people what it was about. And I think what I said goes something like this. see, it's so complicated I can't even remember what it is. Something like, the great thinkers of the world created a secret society in a parallel dimension. And they are something from that parallel dimension has gone horribly wrong, and they're trying to pull this optimistic young girl into it to save it.
Mm, that's pretty good.
Yeah,
I would say that's good. My sort of real quick thing was, what if all the smartest people in the world created a separate dimension? That was it. And they're like, what does that have to do with the girl from Dan in real life? I was like, no, don't worry about that. Don't worry about it. So, okay. So let's go ahead and get into your history with this. This movie, you know, we are specifically talking about it, not only because it is such a film that you had been looking forward to and a film that I had been looking forward to, if I'm being honest. But it's because, like I mentioned, it was written by Damon Lindelof mostly. And for those that maybe are new or haven't heard our discussion on Lost, we spent quite a bit of time on that episode.
just a few, couple, two, 3 hours.
Yeah. And so that was also mostly written by Damon Lindelof. And we also did Prometheus, which was written by Mr. Lindelof. So we are quite the connoisseur of Sir Damon's, screenwriting. So tell me about you in this film and, you know, back when it was called, 1952?
1952, yeah. 4 years ago, this was like the first major news about Damon Lindelof after Lost ended was that he had this original family sci-fi movie that he pitched to Disney and that Disney bought. And then the first thing, hint of what it was about was that he allegedly found this box in the Walt Disney Studio archives marked 1952 and that's what inspired the film. Then a year later, Brad Bird is hired, and then not too long after that, they announce that the name of the movie is Tomorrowland. Mm. So you've got Damon Lindelof, who wrote my favorite TV show of all time. You've got Brad Bird, who worked on The Simpsons and worked for Disney and Pixar and made all these great movies. And then you've got the name Tomorrowland, which is clearly a reference to the section of every castle park. around the world that Disney has a Tomorrowland. So Disneyland, Magic Kingdom, Tokyo Disneyland, all of those. So this is like the perfect confluence of everything I like in one movie. You have science fiction, Damon Lindelof, Brad Bird, Disney, Disneyland. It's amazing. It's like someone was making Sean Stanglin the movie.
There it is. That's really funny.
So to say I was looking forward to this is an unbelievable understatement.
Right, because this was your number one most anticipated, right?
Oh, yeah. Like, even more than Star Wars Episode 7, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, maybe that's taking it too far. Because once you see the Star Wars trailer in the theater with the John Williams music, you're kind of like, okay, I'd rather die than die. I'd rather not die. I, you know what I'm trying to say.
That's, yes. So, I guess for me, this was a movie where I heard about it and knew of it. And I think I knew more of it from, either your retweets or your responses than I did from just my own knowing about it. Like from,
yes.
Cause it's not like I searched any information about this. I just knew that it was Brad Bird, Damon Lindelof, and it was something along the lines of like a Disney-ish sci-fi movie.
Yeah,
something
until,
to do with Disney.
Right, and until the first teaser trailer hit late last year, all of the marketing that was done in the very early stages was all targeted at Disney Parks fans.
Mm.
It was targeted people who know about the 1964 World's Fair and who know about what Walt Disney's original vision of Epcot Center was. So it was very targeted at super nerds like myself. And if you sought that stuff out, you had a pretty good idea of what the movie was about. Now, John and Joan Q. Public, though, just looking at the trailers, apparently have no clue what this movie's about, because that's what I kept hearing, was that even though the trailers look cool, people didn't know what the hell the movie was about.
Yeah, and you know, before we get into the discussion, that's one of the things that is a real blight on the film audience as a whole, I think, is you know, I hear, I don't know what it is. Well, great. Good.
Yeah, exactly. You
know, you're supposed to be enticed to go see it.
Yes, the first trailer, the teaser that came out, where it's just her touching the pin,
yes,
and getting zapped
in the
alternate
tail, yes,
reality.
That was great.
Yes, and my friend in Minnesota who was interested in the movie at that point, he said that should be the only trailer they ever release.
That would be wonderful.
Yes, but even fewer people would know what the movie was about, but there wouldn't be anything to tell them. There wouldn't be any cues to let them think that it's about Disneyland,
yeah,
which I think a lot of people do end up thinking that it's a movie about Disneyland, but it's not at all.
Right, yeah, especially because she looks off in the distance and sees the castle, you know, and it's,
yeah,
like, oh, is that okay? It's a Disneyland thing. All right.
Yeah, and there's even like, you can't see it in that shot, but on the posters and in the movie itself, you can see Space Mountain.
Mm.
So, and even though Damon Lindelof did all these interviews where he said, oh, we told Disney executives we're not going to go on Space Mountain and sell your theme park. Well, Space Mountain was on the poster and in the movie.
yeah, so you know, I didn't know much about it. I also had to field the question of, oh, so like what comic is this based on? And I said, oh no, it's an original deal. Oh, so it's not based on a book either, or no?
Nope.
It's an original story. Oh, okay. You know, that was literally the reaction I got was, oh, really? It's, oh, shit.
It's like people can't fathom the idea that a tentpole release from Disney would not be based on something.
Yeah, really. And
that's the climate we're in.
Yeah, that's true. I guess it is what it is, but that's very sad to me. And I mean, I like the comic book movies. You know, I'm a comic book guy, but I just, you know, I find that the older I'm getting, the more I'm not enjoying them, I guess I should say, is how I should put it. I'm enjoying them less as we go, except for Captain America 2. I really like that.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah. So, okay. So let's get into the actual movie then. What, you know, this is a thing where sometimes when you get so excited, you fall victim to your own expectations and the movie kind of disappoints and, you know, it doesn't quite live up to what you want it to be. And I know that that's something that I really struggle with. That's that's a reason why I haven't seen the movie Drive still, because at one point I was so excited to see it and I still haven't got around to watching it.
Just because there's no way it could live up to what's in your head.
Kind of, yeah. I was like, oh my God, this is going to be so cool. I'm going to really like this. Like, this is going to, you know, I was sitting there watching the trailer going, this is going to be my new favorite movie. That's the sort of label that I put on it. And then now I'm like, ugh, I just need to get that out of my head before I watch the film.
That's kind of what happened to me with Interstellar last year, where I just assumed that would be my favorite movie, and I was so hyped to see it. I was like, how could this not be the best movie of the year? And then I saw it, and I was like, oh.
That's how.
That's not what I thought it was going to be at all.
So how did you manage those expectations with this film, and what did you think of 12?
Well, it became pretty clear to me a couple weeks before it came out that I pretty much knew everything that was going to happen in it already. Mm-hmm. And I do that a lot to myself, and I think I do it on purpose, where I spoil movies for myself, and it actually, I think, helps manage the expectations, because then I can just judge the movie for how well it's accomplishing what it's doing, as opposed to, you know, getting wrapped up in the machinations of the plot or twists or things that I want to happen.
Now, let me ask you this before you get going. Does that have any, do you think, and based on our previous discussions, do you think that has something to do with Lost?
No, it goes back before that. I remember, you know, knowing pretty much everything that would happen in like Attack of the Clones, and that's what, 13 years ago now.
Okay.
So I just remember, the earliest I can remember actively looking for spoilers on a movie was Star Trek First Contact. And that's before, like, even the internet was, like, you know, the place you went to find things out. And I remember going to see that and knowing pretty much everything that was going to happen in it. So I think my enthusiasm, you know, my youthful enthusiasm is still there when you talk about movies that I really want to see. Like these big movies, like, there's always movies that sneak up and surprise you, but when you have these big anticipated movies, I somehow find a way to spoil it for myself, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. I'm fine with that.
Well, I guess as long as you're, you know, as long as that's something that you know that you're doing, you know, it's like, okay, well, I can intellectually understand that my youthful enthusiasm is going to make me figure out all the things that are happening here.
Yes.
So it's less about the plot and more about the execution.
Yes. Okay. That's how most of these movies turn out for me, yes.
Okay, so what did you think? How well do you think Brad Bird and company executed this film?
Well, for about 90 minutes, I thought it was about the most entertaining movie it could have been. Mm-hmm. It was a movie very much about the journey.
Mm-hmm.
Like, not unlike Close Encounters in some ways, where these characters are kind of have this shared obsession with something that the audience doesn't quite know what's going to happen when we get there. The difference with Tomorrowland is that we see so much of Tomorrowland before they get there that we want to see more of it. So when we get to the end of the film and it's not what we thought it was going to be, because Tomorrowland by that time is on the downside, and when we get there, we really see like maybe two different sites of the, you know, at the city.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a big speech, and then there's a really lame action scene, and then it's over. And I have to say that I kind of wonder if the script was much longer and they decided they liked the journey better than the destination, so they cut a bunch of stuff out at the end, or if maybe Damon Lindelof just doesn't know how to write anything except for television.
Interesting. Like, he doesn't know how to truncate things.
Yeah, because I think if you showed this as the pilot of a TV show,
I think
everyone would love it. It would be like, people would be going crazy for it if this was the pilot of a TV show. But it's going to be a self-contained movie based on the box office receipts. So by the time we get to Tomorrowland, and we're there for 25 minutes, you can't help but feel disappointed.
That's really interesting. You know what? This is going to be weird. I think I liked it more than you did.
Wow.
So the like I said, the way that we came about it was, you know, I knew of it, like I said, and I decided that, that NL and I were going to watch this and we're going to bring Anna. And she, as of recording, is still 6, not quite 7 yet. And so we were like, well, sweetie, it's going to be long, right? So it's a long movie. So if you need to get up, that's fine. Just, you know, it's just so you know. And so she's like, all right. And so she sat there and was a little squirmy at times, but she kind of knew what it was about.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, oh yeah, that's where they go into that place. And she touches that pin and then it's like, she's in like a different world or something. And I was like, oh yeah, that's a pretty good synopsis.
She got it better than most of my, fellow 30-year-old peers.
Yeah. And so I'm like, okay. And so she is, you know, is watching it and is, tense, and Anel is tense during the fights with the robots. And all of the early action sequences. And I think that the way that they came out with more of a, more of like the rah-rah ending and that sort of feeling, I think that permeated her a little bit more than maybe our 30 plus year old selves.
Oh, I love the rah-rah ending. I just have some problems with how we got to the rah-rah ending.
Okay. So I think that while, you know, I wasn't quite sitting right next to her, like Anel was in the middle of us, and so it wasn't like she was – it's not like her energy was seeping into me and I was, you know, enjoying it because of her, you know. Mm-hmm. It wasn't quite like that, but I definitely could feel her energy when things were getting more tense.
Yeah.
On the tense side. But yeah, I mean, I thought that, it got a little G at towards the end, I guess.
A little G?
Yeah, like a little G rated, like a little, like a little silly goofy with the Clooney and Hugh Laurie fighting stuff.
Yeah, that's pretty lame stuff to end your big sci-fi action movie with.
I thought it was a little like ABC Family, I guess is the way.
Yeah.
You know?
And I mean, it just doesn't feel like a movie that should end with any kind of violent conflict, whether it's lame or not. I don't know.
Yeah, and I mean, we can get into the end in a little bit, but I enjoyed it fine, but I wasn't overwhelmed by it, but I didn't walk out feeling disappointed in it either. That being said, if she asks for it, we would probably get it for her, but I don't know that I would be seeking it out again.
Yeah, well, it's a day one buy for me on Blu-ray for sure.
Well, just the Giacchino music, right?
Well, that's part of all. Yeah, we'll talk about that too. But I mean, I think this is a movie where for the right audience, the documentaries and commentaries on
sure.
Could be way more interesting than the movie itself.
Of course, yes. All the behind the scenes stuff, all the. I'm sure they would have here's the World's Fair, here's what we base this on, here's all of this Disney, influence that we pulled from, all of that kind of stuff.
Oh yeah, they filmed, you know, the movie features It's a Small World, and that is the actual It's a Small World ride at Disneyland where they filmed. And incidentally.
Down the trapdoor yet?
We don't have that yet. they also filmed at the Carousel of Progress at Walt Disney World, which was a World's Fair exhibit first, but that's not in the movie. Walt Disney had the 1964 World's Fair was kind of like Walt Disney's audition for all these things that would become the staples of the Disney parks for the next 40 years, 50 years. Cause he debuted It's a Small World. He debuted the Carousel Progress, which was the first audio animatronics show. And I like, they call the robots audio animatronics in the movie. And, he debuted, there was a Ford Skyway ride that was like an early prototype for the People Mover, which was at Disneyland for years and is still at Magic Kingdom. And he did the Mr. Lincoln animatronic, which is still in service at Disneyland and Magic Kingdom. So the 1964 World's Fair was a big, big deal for the Disney company. And this movie, they cut a lot of the Disney stuff out of the movie. And I think it was probably smart because they, having just made Saving Mr. Banks, you didn't need another movie from Walt Disney Pictures that like tells people how great Walt Disney was.
Mm-hmm. And left out some of the not so great things about him, right?
Well, yeah, exactly.
They didn't need to glamorize him again.
No. Interesting. I mean, they don't even, you know, you see Walt Disney's It's a Small World on the sign, and I think you hear that said, but Walt is not mentioned as being one of the people in the secret society. You just have to infer that he was, since It's a Small World was the portal to the other dimension.
Yeah, you would think.
Yes.
So. Huh. Well, okay, so what, tell me about, I mean, you enjoyed the first 90 minutes, you said. Tell me about what it is that you enjoyed about that.
Well, I like the, any story about discovery where you have a character that is a good stand-in for the audience and that who you like. And I think Britt Robertson serves that role perfectly. And I like the discovery of it. You have to love the glimpse of Tomorrowland you get about a half an hour into the movie.
Mm, the commercial, right?
Yes. Yeah. What George Clooney ends up calling a commercial. And it makes you want to go there. And when you get there, it's a letdown. I think that's a huge flaw in this movie.
Right.
That you can't promise the audience that your hero is going to get to go there and not deliver on it.
You know what she I thought? I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, she gets there and she's going to make it a better place, but that happens after the movie's over. Right. And I feel like that's not fair to the audience.
You know what I thought was funny about that is, I see that and I hear, a line that, I believe I think you also heard this from Clooney that was real meta.
Yes.
And it made me think that Lindelof's not real happy in Hollywood.
Well, yeah.
It was like, okay, Hollywood represents Tomorrowland. You know, you work so hard to get there and you finally get there and you're expecting it to be great. And then it's such a huge letdown.
Yeah.
And everything's ruined and nothing's like how it should be,
mm.
You know, and it's going to be, it takes this one person to, you know, revive things.
Right? Now that's interesting.
I asked you the lost question earlier. That's definitely a lost thing for me. Like that's me not being able to separate artists from the art. And it's thinking, okay, well, Lindelof likes to write in meta commentary. So
oh, yeah.
Maybe he's doing that. I think the line was something about, like, why do you have to ask so many questions? Can't you just be in awe or something like that? Or can't you just
be amazed? Yes. And the minute Clooney said that, I'm like, oh, Lindelof's still bitching about Lost.
Yeah.
He's still complaining about people reacting to the end of Lost.
Yep, that's what
Which, I thought. Not everybody's going to pick up on that, but, you know, those of us who were hardcore Losties, we know that Damon likes to talk to you directly in his dialogue.
And so that's kind of what I felt like this was doing in a way. And you know, I think that the reason I feel that way is because of the little nugget that you already dropped in there was this was the project that was announced after Lost.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it was like, I don't know if it's the bitter feelings or whatever is what I'm reading into it. It's the sort of, well, things aren't as great as you think they are, audience.
So yeah.
Write this sci-fi film that's going to show you that there's this magical kingdom, no pun intended, or maybe pun intended, that you want to go to, but it's not all that, you know, it's not as great as you think.
It does definitely have Lostian parallels in how, like, you know, there's this nebulous place that you can't quite get to or get out of, and you know only certain people are invited.
Kind of like Prometheus.
Well, I guess there's that too, huh?
He has a little sort of a formula that he likes to write in.
I guess he does.
And I mean, it's not like Tomorrowland and Prometheus are the same sort of film.
No,
it's just not... like, you know, there's certain things about the structure that he goes about in similar ways, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think that's interesting. Well, veering us off course a little bit here, let's talk a little bit about the actors and the acting. And you mentioned Britt Robertson, who I had said is the, you know, the troubled middle child from Dan in Real Life.
Right.
That rom-com with Steve Carell that I think is okay. I don't think that's a great movie, but I think it's cute enough. And I think that I'm a Steve Carell sort of humor, like that uncomfortable humor. That's kind of my sort of thing. And so she was in that, and it was one of those where I saw her, and that was probably 10 years ago or so. And I was like, oh, she's going to be famous. You know, she's going to be a thing. And here she is, you know, she's 25, which I was like, wow, she's way older than I thought she was.
Yeah, she's got that going for her. I think she'll be able to play high school kids until she's 30, probably.
Right. And so I was like, well, geez, like, as long, you know, I remember going to this and I was like, as long as this doesn't bomb, she should do really well for herself. And then, you know, I think it was a few days ago where I try to not pay too much attention to that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
Twitter gives me plenty of the information for that, right? And I think I saw you post the numbers or whatever, and it was like 52 million or 56 million or something. And I was like, holy shit. Like that's no good.
Well, it had the lowest Memorial Day debut in 20 years.
Mm.
So that'll tell you.
Well,
I mean, it's a tough sell. It's a tough sell.
I don't think that's a representation of the film, though. I think that that's more to blame for me on the marketing of the movie.
It's the marketing, and I think it'd be, even if they had the best marketing campaign imaginable for the movie, it would still be hard to get get big numbers for this movie. Nobody is making PG-rated movies aimed at, I don't know, I guess I'd say 14 to 18 year olds.
Yeah.
You know, if you're aiming a movie at that crowd, it's a PG-13 action spectacular.
It's Transformers or something.
It's Transformers or it's Avengers.
Yeah.
So this is a totally different animal. This feels more like, I don't know, I guess like the movies Joe Dante used to make in the 80s.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Like that, like that kind of movie. Not the kind of movie that you would spend $190 million to make.
Sure.
But I'm glad they spent that money because it all went to those, to the effects of making Tomorrowland, and it is rather spectacular.
Well, yeah, and there's quite a few different, you know, even the action sequences I think are really good.
The thing in the house is great.
Yeah, the thing in the house is really good. I really enjoyed the toy store that they went to.
Mm-hmm.
That was one where I was, you know, I don't get that surprise often. You know, even in movies that I don't know anything about, I feel like, oh, okay, I see the formula. I can see, you know, the puppet, then the puppet master. And they go in there and I'm like, okay, well, they're going to have something to do with something. And I think it was the combination of the sound of, like, the way that the sound design was, and the way that they use the kind of silly ray gun looking props.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this is a lot of fun. Like, I'm really enjoying myself. And I think that the choreography in the fight sequence is really good because they're bashing around Britt Robertson and throwing her around, or the stunt double or whoever.
Yeah.
You know, and everyone's getting thrown around, and the little one, you know, what's sad is I gotta look up her name.
Rafe Cassidy.
Oh, there you go. She, you know, is smashing people, but since she's such a little thing, you know, she's having to beat them up over and over and over, even though she's a little robot. And so all of those things were going on, and I'm like, God, I'm kind of with this. Like, I'm really liking this.
Oh,
this,
yeah.
Action sequence. And what's funny about that is that's off the heels of, you know, we haven't quite finished the series, but we've been watching quite a bit of Daredevil. Which is much more violent in a much different tone in terms of the fight sequences.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm watching them, and we saw Mad Max Fury Road not too long ago also. And so we're like, well, these are much different in terms of the way that they're just showing the action. But I'm really enjoying this very physical, very, I'm really... It's almost like a tangible action compared to when I see something like a Transformers or an Avengers even.
It is
I don't feel that as much, you know?
Well, yeah. I think another thing that may be causing problems for people when they watch this movie is the fact that you have this 10-year-old girl participating in all the action and driving the cars and getting hit by a car.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, so on one hand, it makes it feel more real because it's happening, but it's also absurd. It's like these two opposite aesthetics like clashing, and I think it's putting some people off. Hmm. But you got to really hand it to that Rafe Cassidy.
Oh man,
girl. She is asked to carry this movie for a good 45 minutes, where she gets all the exposition. She's in nearly every scene for like the most important stretch of the movie as far as plot development wise goes, and I've never seen her before.
No.
And there's a few parts where you can see her stumbling over the fast dialogue she has to get out, but she makes it work. And she somehow makes a tearful goodbye with George Clooney at the end of the movie work.
What do you know, we haven't really mentioned George Clooney. What do you think of George Clooney in this?
I had read the first review of this movie that I read said that he was horribly miscast. And I have been trying to see if I agree with that or not. And I don't know. I think he's a good pick for the character, but I just don't, he just doesn't look comfortable in a lot of this movie. Like, he doesn't know how to act in a movie that's rated PG, aimed at kids, that's a big tentpole movie like this. Mm-hmm. It's like he doesn't look like he belongs. And I wonder how much of that is on him and how much of it is on us. Just because we've never seen him in a movie like this.
Yeah,
at least not since Batman and Robin.
Sure. That's a good point, because I think that he has a problem playing big when he's not playing his charming, sophisticated self.
Right. Yeah.
Because he can be subtle in Michael Clayton and you know, several other films that he's been in, mm-hmm. Where he's, you know, trying to do something different. But here, he's having to be like a bigger character, and he's supposed to be someone that things haven't gone right for.
Right.
And I never look at George Clooney and think, damn, he's got it rough.
Yeah, like, oh, he's got some stubble and he's wearing a plaid shirt. So that's our only clue that he's a loser, apparently.
Yeah. And what's so weird is I never in my wildest dreams would have ever thought, especially as like a teenage kid, or maybe whenever it was that George Clooney became famous,
yeah,
that I would say, damn, that Tim McGraw did a better job than George Clooney in that movie.
Wow.
Because I was like, all right, well, I think Tim McGraw's doing an all right job.
Well, like, I mean,
like, he's not asked to do a lot, but I'm like, okay, he's holding his own.
Yeah, he did okay. I mean, he wasn't as good as he was in Friday Night Live.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. All right. That's true. But and so I'm watching George and I'm like, okay, like, you know, he wasn't, it wasn't like an eyesore. It wasn't like I was like, oh God, this is awful. This is the worst thing I've ever seen. You know, I didn't have that kind of a reaction, but I was just like, I don't know. Like, this makes me feel like it's a Spy Kids movie.
Mm.
Because it's big action, not a lot of substance at times, and characters who don't quite know what they're playing, or they do, and it's just really silly. And that's what I felt like he was doing.
I never made that connection, that Spy Kids connection, but now maybe that is what maybe that was his approach in this movie.
Because it seems like it's like, no, this is Spy Kids, but we have a lot of money.
Well, yeah.
You know, it's like, we're really going to actually make the effects look good. It's not just going to be some some haberdash sort of.
It's thing. Not Robert Rodriguez working on his laptop.
Yeah, he's not in his house working at 4 a.m. like a Sin City sort of thing.
You know, Clooney is the only person in this movie who's even less than stellar. Everybody in this movie is great.
I would say so, sure.
Britt Robertson, you started to talk about her before. I've been watching her for a long time. She's been on a string of failed TV shows that I started watching and thought, well, this isn't that good, but I like her.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept waiting. And when she was announced for this movie, I got really excited. I was like, this could be finally the thing that makes her a big star. And it might, you know, just because the movie flopped doesn't mean the casting directors aren't seeing it.
So you're telling me that you ventured in underneath the dome.
I did see a few episodes of Under the Dome and Life Unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
And she's really good. And casting directors hopefully will see this movie or hear about this movie, because she absolutely knocks it out of the park.
Yeah,
she's great.
She is very good. She has that sort of that sense of being like a strong female presence, because she's able to come off as being smart and capable,
mm-hmm.
and she kind of gets in over her head a little bit, and you're sort of rooting mm-hmm. for her, you know. But I think that she was good. You know, I had no problems with her whatsoever.
Yeah, she's asked to play just the entire spectrum, and you know she has probably the funniest. It's just a shame that she gets marginalized in the finale.
Yeah, that is a shame.
I get the ending of this movie, but anyway.
Yeah. So no, I think the cast is good. I think the storyline is interesting. I think that there is a lot of things to like about it. Let's talk a little bit about what you didn't like. Let's get into the ending. Tell me about the end and what you really had issues with.
Okay, so my problem is not the preachiness, which is a lot of people's problems. I don't mind the preachiness. I think that's part of what true science fiction should do, is to be a bit of a morality tale and maybe even preach at you a little bit.
Oh, now we've seen plenty of Star Trek.
Yes, exactly.
Right? And it's, you know, Damoc and Jalad at Galadra.
Exactly. And goddamn, wouldn't Hugh Laurie be a fantastic Star Trek villain?
Oh, absolutely.
But anyway.
It'd be just like Ronnie Cox. Get it done.
Yeah, I guess he would, wouldn't he? Admiral Jellicoe? Or is he Captain Jell? Whatever.
Something like that. There are four lights.
Captain,
that's what I know.
Captain Jagoff. Whatever. Oh, God. So anyway, a movie about optimism and making a better world and all the ideals that it purports to be about, that the filmmakers have told us it's about, shouldn't end with this lame-ass violent finale. And it shouldn't end with what amounts to a suicide bombing by a 10-year-old girl who happens to be a robot. It's just like there's some kind of disconnect for me where the movie ends with Frank giving Casey a bomb. And then I don't even get what she's supposed to do with the bomb or what happens to the bomb, that she doesn't get to use it. And then Athena sacrifices herself for Frank and then becomes a suicide bomb to blow up the monitor, which we haven't mentioned. The monitor is the invention that Frank made that basically predicted the end of the world based on the fact that it was broadcasting the end of the world to people, and people assumed the end of the world would happen. I think that's about how it goes.
I was going to say, now why was it broadcasting the end of the world to begin with? It just thought that it was going to happen?
Because Hugh Laurie, I think, wanted to warn people that this is what is going to happen. So he was putting all this negative imagery in the media. But it turned out that we laughed it up and we loved it.
Does that sound familiar? I mean, you're in journalism.
Well,
you tell
I
me.
Mean, yeah. I mean, I love the speech from Hugh Laurie, and I like the idea of it, but I don't think that they quite landed it in the explanation. But that's not my problem with the ending. I just think that it deserved a better ending. It deserved an ending where they could figure things out together. I don't like the fact that they killed David Nix, who's Hugh Laurie's character, and they kill him on a joke. He says bollocks, and then he dies. And, you know, okay, so maybe he had it coming. I mean, he did have an army of robots that were vaporizing people in the real world. But
right.
But it, the villain has this big speech, and I was kind of on his side after that speech, quite honestly. It was very convincing. And I just felt like having this violent finale where our hero is marginalized and then ending in what it amounts to a suicide bombing just didn't really fit with the whole spirit of the movie.
Hmm. It's interesting. You know, I guess I knew that you had problems with it, but I didn't know specifically what you had problems with.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I don't know that I was really that bothered by it, if I'm being honest.
Yeah.
I think I just saw it and was like, this is sort of how action movies are.
Yeah.
And I think that I sort of, like, I saw the big fighting robots and was like, all right, this is kind of silly, whatever.
Yeah, that was too much.
And then I see them on the island, and they're kind of, you know, like, essentially slap fighting and just kind of goofing around. And I'm that's kind of fun. And then he dies, and I'm like, oh, whatever. You know, and I just never really had, the ending never really had much of an impact at all. Like, I think that's the thing that bothers me is the film didn't leave an impression either way. Like, I don't mind if a film is like Sunshine or Prometheus, where I'm like, oh, shit, if they had only done this, you know, or, oh, they were so close. Like, why can't you have a film that, you know, ends in such an interesting way? And so that's not really the way that this one ended up for me. I was just kind of like, okay, well, I kind of liked that. I thought that was all right. Like, I really liked that end bit. And, you know, this first two thirds is really good. But I just kind of was a little flatlined by the end. I wasn't really that perturbed by it or anything like that, though.
Well, I think it might have been compounded for me by the very last sequence where you see the people that they're handing the pins to, the new recruits to come to tomorrow.
Right, yes.
And the second person that they go to is in a Chevrolet design studio designing a car. And above, right on the table where the woman finds the Tomorrowland pin, right before she grabs a pin, you see a giant Chevrolet logo.
Mm.
And not only that, but there is an attraction at Epcot called Test Track, sponsored by Chevrolet, where the line goes through something that looks very much like that scene. And it's just like, you're gonna tell me that this movie is going to end with Chevrolet saying that a Chevrolet designer is one of the greatest people in the world. And that just, I mean, I get more pissed off about product placement than a lot of people. And there are some other bad product placement in this movie too.
Oh, there's some. The Coke thing is ridiculous.
I know. And I haven't seen anybody even mention that. It's so egregious. Not as egregious as this thing at the end, though.
Right.
And it just felt so whorish to me in a movie that was like, that wanted to be the opposite of that.
That's what's so funny is it's a film that is about kind of, you know, having an independent spirit and making a better tomorrow. No, again, no pun intended again. And it's about those sort of things, but it's sponsored by Chevrolet, sponsored by Coke. Here, you know, and even the parent company, it's, you know, here's Disney, like one of the huge corporations. You know, here's Disney telling you how to be an individual. I'm like, oh, really? Okay. You know,
it's almost like the opposite of WALL-E, which was another Disney movie, you know, another movie from the biggest entertainment conglomerate in the world that wound up being very critical of the consumers that keep that conglomerate alive. Mm-hmm. But it worked in that movie because they didn't do anything that cheapened the message, I thought. I thought WALL-E is Pixar's best movie, I think. And the fact that it was released by Disney is a miracle. And I do wonder how much of the stuff in this movie was from executives who were like, well, we can't have another WALL-E.
You know,
never mind that WALL-E is probably going to be exponentially a bigger hit than this movie.
Yeah. You know what's funny about WALL-E is that was a movie when it came out. I have these movies where I have this immediate sort of blowback against them.
Mm.
And it comes out and all these critics are talking about how it's great. And I listen to these different podcasts and they're like, oh, it's just fantastic. And I'm like, oh, that doesn't look so fucking good. You know, it's got this short circuit looking design. I'm not going to like that movie, right? even up until that point, I had no problems with any of the Pixar movies that I'd seen, because I skipped Cars, because I'm wise. And so I finally getting around to see it, and that is probably my most referenced Pixar movie.
Because
I'm like, oh yeah, like you're going to be big and fat and stupid like these, like the guys from Wall-E. Right? Like you're just going to have everything fed to you like you're from Wall-E. Or I'll say, you know, we'll look at things technologically, and I'm like, oh yeah, and all it needs to do now is feed us like in Wall-E, you know? And it's just like these different references come out of nowhere, and I don't mean to really make them, and I kind of realize after a while, I'm like, Jesus Christ, I'm referencing that movie that I've seen a lot, or that I've referenced that a lot, and I've seen it maybe twice, you know, but it had that much of an impact on me. And I think that this, where Wall-E, you know, not only is it a Pixar movie, but it's kind of anti-establishment in some ways. It is a much riskier film. This felt very safe and felt very, well, you know, let's just kind of make sure everyone's happy. And I would have never guessed that from a Damon Lindelof movie. You know what I mean?
Well, safe in how, just in how it all wraps up, or?
Yeah, I think just safe in that there's just kind of like some silly, there's some silly safe action. There's some, there's some product placement everywhere so that we know our sponsors are okay. Well, there's no sort of, I mean, there's a call to action about being a better person, but that's, you know, if you really start to think about it, that's like every sort of biopic that they're like, oh, you could be just like this guy, you know, that, that kind of ending. So I don't know. It just, in the end, the overall sort of impression felt safe, I guess.
So what do you think they're actually going to do for the real world now that they're in Tomorrowland?
Yeah, see, that's a really good point. I don't know, because it's like we have sort of given up on the real world, right? We're going to focus our energies on this Tomorrowland. So we're taking the best and the brightest out of the real world, and we're focusing them to this this sort of parallel world or whatever, pocket universe or something. And so I was just like, okay, well, so they're not going to flood anymore, I guess. but the regular world's just going to be how it is, and they're just taking these really bright and gifted people away, or? All right.
And I think that's the safest choice that they made, was to not ever explain that. Explain why people deserve to be in Tomorrowland, and why, and what they were actually doing there. Like, they never explicitly tell you, well, the things that we did in Tomorrowland ended up causing this and this and this in the real world. Like, there was not a moment where, like, George Clooney says, oh, well, you know that smartphone you have, well, you only have that because I invented this in Tomorrowland. There's not a moment like that in the movie. And there's no hint of, you know, so they saved the real world by destroying the monitor, but they're going to take more people from the real world into Tomorrowland. But what are they doing there? Are they improving Tomorrowland, or are they doing things in Tomorrowland that will improve the whole world? And that's never said, and I think that's the safest choice they make. Because whatever, I don't know, whatever explanation they come up with could have put some people off. So they just decide to not explain it, which, you know, some people would say that's the Lindelof way too, isn't it? So,
yeah.
And if you don't explain it, then either people overlook it or they talk about it later like we are right now.
Yeah. I don't know. I just thought, yeah, I guess I just always thought that they were working on fixing what was left of Tomorrowland.
Yes.
And I guess I just sort of forgot about the whole, how it influences the real world aspect.
Exactly. So yeah, like, so does the new regime in Tomorrowland, do they even care about the real world, or are they just like, let's just bring NASA over here since the real world doesn't give two shits about NASA anymore?
Yeah, really. Yeah.
And that's another thing that suggests to me that this would have been better as a TV pilot too. Cause it's, oh, like, there's so many other jumping off points for this.
Well, right, because then you could see either how it does or doesn't impact the real world, how, you know, people don't get, you know, people aren't pleased about being selected or whatever. And,
yeah, exactly.
You know, there's a whole host of things that you could go through.
Yeah, and, that, you know, even, like, if you think about Prometheus, even that is kind of constructed like a TV pilot.
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess makes sense because it's a prequel to this big overarching series, but it does make you raise an eyebrow and wonder maybe movies just aren't what Damon Lindelof should be doing.
Yeah, because it's a thing where it's like, okay, well, here's this one event, now we're off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's very much like a pilot. Now we've set the stage and here we go. So, I don't know. I mean, he's a guy who makes very, very interesting movies, I think. And I think that what's interesting about them is I love how, you know, we had mentioned that he has similar story structures, but placed in different hands and different subject matter. I love how they are so very different.
Yeah, they are very different.
You know, you give it to Ridley Scott and then you put it in the world of Alien and it's Prometheus. You give it to Brad Bird and you know, the director of The Iron Giant, who, you know, there's a couple of different cases where I'm like, oh, Hogarth. He looks like Hogarth. He's got all of his, you know, his jetpack and stuff.
That.
Yeah, and it's like, oh, it's The Iron Giant. Because I really, really like that movie. But
it's great.
And so there's things where I'm like, okay, well, this is Brad Bird's vision. And so I think it's interesting how Lindelof is really able to kind of collaborate and make things that are very director specific, but yet also have his Lindelof isms that are,
well, and you know, Lindelof is taking the blame or the credit for this movie.
Oh,
and
I don't know if that's, of course he is. He loves falling on his sword though.
Well, yeah. And I don't know if that's entirely accurate because I don't think Brad Bird does anything that he doesn't have a bunch of input into. I heard the Empire film podcast where Damon says that David Nix is very much a Brad Bird creation.
Mm.
And to the point where Brad Bird actually sympathizes with David Nix most of any character in the movie.
Oh, interesting. But
Damon Lindelof, he puts himself out there. He decided somewhere along the line that he was going to be a star screenwriter or a star showrunner. And he has to own it.
Mm-hmm.
And as being that guy, he is that guy who puts himself out there like that. He's going to take the amount of shit that he does. So, but yeah, he sure does love to play the victim too.
Oh, he does. Yeah. You know, what's interesting is I think that, someone that's, I don't know if it's similar, but someone that has his hand in a lot of things like that, like what Damon Lindelof has is, Kurt Sutter. The former writer of The Shield and then creator of Sons of Anarchy. And then he is, I guess I should look this up, but I'm not sure if he wrote and directed Southpaw with Jake Gyllenhaal.
Oh, that's right. Out. He wrote it. I believe, I forget who the director is, but I know he wrote it.
Okay. And so, oh, it's Antoine Fuqua.
Oh, Fuqua.
There yeah. So Kurt Sutter is a guy who is, I feel, could be like that, to where he's a guy who's got his hands on a lot of different things, right? He's only written five different projects. You know, it's The Shield, Sons of Anarchy, and Southpaw, basically. And then a new TV series called The Bastard Executioner. But he's a guy where I think that if he's going to be successful in Hollywood, he is going to do it because he's a personality, right? Because he's like, look, written by Kurt Sutter.
Right.
You know, he doesn't hide it. And it's like, this is a big deal. This is written by me. This is the Sons of Anarchy guy. This is the Shield guy. You know?
And for me, he is, for me, what Damon Lindelof is for other people. I have seen almost none of his stuff, but I've seen him and I've read comments from him and I don't like him. So therefore, I'm not gonna consume his stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So the door definitely swings both ways.
Yeah, that's funny because he's much more of a gruesome, tangible, tactile kind of a, you know, that's the sort of things that he makes.
Yeah.
Like, it's very bloody. It's very in your face. And Damon Lindelof is not that usually. It's more, what does it all mean? Where did we come from? Much more in line with your sensibilities, Sean.
Yes, I suppose that's true.
Right. Because that's definitely the sorts of movies that we talk about. Definitely in comparison. One of the things that we have not mentioned is, what you feel like about this movie in comparison to our last discussion.
Jupiter Ascending?
Our last discussion was Jupiter Ascending by the Wachowskis, who are, another favorite creator of yours.
Well, they're both, wildly
divisive, yes.
In divisive works of science fiction about whom the best things are the Michael Giacchino score.
Right.
I think this is a better movie than Jupiter Ascending.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's clearly a better movie.
Well, it's definitely doesn't pander to the ladies like Jupiter Ascending does.
Well, right? I hadn't thought of that, but I think it has something to say that Jupiter Ascending I don't think really does. I think Jupiter Ascending is mostly content with being a totally gonzo Terry Gilliam wannabe sci-fi movie, where this movie wants to say something, which is why I think I'm grading it on a harder scale, because this movie so clearly wants to tell you something. I really enjoyed this movie. I just wish it had ended better.
There you go. And I did want to bring up the Wachowskis though, because I believe probably our next recording.
Oh geez, that's
with Sean,
right.
Maybe the upcoming, as of release of this, the upcoming Friday series premiere on Netflix of Sense8.
Yeah, and I hope I can carve out time to knock all of those down in short order.
Well, and the thing is we don't have to watch those for a specific recording. We'll watch those whenever we watch those, and whenever we get to it, we get to it. And if we decide, you know what, I don't really have a lot to say about this, then we don't have to. We're not obligated by anyone to do.
Oh, I'm sure we'll have plenty to say. Funnily enough, we are recording this on the day that Jupiter Ascending comes out on Blu-ray, DVD, and video on demand.
Is that right?
That is correct.
And I believe there's Cricket's U.S. round, except yeah. Over at the Stangland house.
You know, it was $24.98 everywhere I went today. I'm like, buy this if it was $17 or $18 just to show my support, but I'm not gonna shell out $25 for it.
Yeah. Is it loaded with
I wouldn't say it's loaded. It's got the same, like, you know, it's one interview documentary segment broken up into seven parts, like the Cloud Atlas Blu-ray probably.
That's too bad.
Yes.
It's too bad. God damn. I wish they would do something that was written by someone who is a smarter screenwriter than they are.
Who, the Wachowskis?
Yes.
Well, I think they're gonna be forced to at some point.
What if they
keep making movies?
How about we have a Damon Lindelof Wachowskis mashup?
Oh my God, what would that be?
Your mind would explode, I think.
It would
because you know that Lindelof would reach for something. He'd try to say something.
Mm-hmm.
And you know the Wachowskis would make it look fucking awesome, whatever it is.
Wow.
I mean, that would be one of the riskier Hollywood premises for in a while, though.
I don't know who you'd get to fund that. You'd have to do that on like a shoestring budget. I don't know if those people can work on shoestring budgets at this point.
Well,
I'd like
know.
To see them try.
I guess we'll see how Sense8 goes.
Yeah. Well, yeah. The early buzz is disappointing, but it's not going to stop me from watching.
I didn't hear you say that.
No, you didn't.
I didn't hear anything negative about it. Just like how I haven't heard anything negative about The Leftovers, which I'm also going to watch and enjoy, despite what other people think.
I've been meaning to go back and watch that. It's just so heavy.
Yeah, that's so what I heard. I do have, you know, I mentioned the spot earlier from Audible. I do have from Audible, The Leftovers, downloaded on my phone. And I,
there you go.
That's one of the things I'll be listening to on my commute to school every day.
Nicely done.
So once once this fall gets here, I'll be listening to that. And I probably honestly won't get around to watching the HBO series until then. And by then, season two will be upon us. I believe in the fall. We'll see. I think it's supposed to be something around there. Okay, well, I guess before we move along and before we start wrapping up, let's talk a little bit about Mr. Giacchino.
Yes. So first of all, did you see him in the movie?
No, I didn't.
He is the one who stops the line on It's a Small World, allowing the empty boat to go.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, so that he is working the line on It's a Small World in the beginning of the movie.
That's really good. Well, good for him. I mean, shit, he's been carrying his load and then some for a long time.
I don't think there's, if anyone had any doubts that this guy was the heir to the John Williams throne,
mm-hmm.
those doubts are completely erased by now.
Mm-hmm.
This is a John Williams score in this movie.
Well, it is, you know, and it definitely captures the wonder of what Tomorrowland is supposed to be.
Absolutely. And I think it's his most well-rounded, film score so far. It doesn't have any real lulls in it, and it doesn't have these passages of abstract music that he can sometimes fall into. It's just kind of wall-to-wall, listenable action music with these big, broad, beautiful themes, one of which, the Frank theme, just happens to sound a little bit like the Grail theme from Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. And it's just, the album posted to Spotify the Monday before the movie came out, and I listened to it all week, that week, without even seeing the movie. How often can you listen to a film score without even seeing the movie? So it's staggering work, and the guy's got Jurassic World arriving in a week and a half, and then a week after that, Inside Out, which played at Cannes and got Best Picture talk immediately.
Yeah, the best thing Pixar's ever made was one of the things I saw, and I was like, what? Yes.
Yeah, I've seen that too.
It was one of those where I was like, okay, you have my attention, cute little movie that I kind of was going to ignore.
Yeah, exactly. The trailers were not that promising, and then when it plays at Cannes of all places and the praise is that effusive, you have to stand up and take notice.
Now, I will say that the trailer for it in front of Tomorrowland was much better than the first one I thought.
Oh yeah, the first trailer was awful. It was like, oh, it was all like women are this way and men are this way type of humor, and it's like that's like the lowest common denominator of humor.
It was something, it was like Paul Blart sort of, and I was like, oh boy, you know, is this? I was thinking like, is this Pixar's big whiff? Much like how I feel like Ant-Man is going to be Marvel's big whiff.
Oh, yeah, I'm with you on that.
You know, and I was like, is this going to finally be it? And then it turns out it's getting the highest praise that any Pixar thing has gotten in a while. And I'm like, what?
Holy it just goes to show you that marketing doesn't tell you anything about, I mean, that Disney really doesn't seem to know how to market their movies. And you'd think that the biggest entertainment company in the world would know how to market their movies.
You would think. I wonder if it's like a case of just too many hats, you know,
yeah.
or too many things to look at, or I don't know, like too many gates to pass before we get an okay on what the preview is going to be, or I don't know.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. I'm trying to figure out how the feature film division of that company was allowed to release Tron Legacy, Prince of Persia, Lone Ranger, John Carter, and Tomorrowland.
Oof. Like, I mean, that is
like
a lot of bullets.
Aside from Prince of Persia, I like all of those movies to some degree. But how did one studio release all those expensive flops? Tron Legacy, it was the most successful. It did $400 million worldwide, which doesn't sound like a flop, but when you consider how much they spent on it and how much they spent to market it, that's not exactly what they were going for.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, like, John Carter and Lone Ranger were disasters. And this, Tomorrowland, when the receipts come in, might be the biggest flop of all of them.
And that's what's crazy is you see, you know, Lone Ranger has Johnny Depp, sure, but is, you know, basically an unknown lead, right? You're going on the character more than anything.
Right.
John Carter, nobody knew what the fuck that was.
No, and then they put Taylor Kitsch in it, who has the, I mean, he's a zero. I don't know how that guy keeps getting jobs.
Well, see, the thing about him is people see him and they're like, oh, hey, it's Riggins from Friday Night Lights. And then the next person's like, what? I never saw that movie.
Yeah, exactly. The 100,000 people who watch Friday Night Lights are excited.
Yeah, and they're like, oh, fuck yeah. You know, it's John Carter from Mars. You know, let's go check it out. And everyone's like, I have no idea what you're talking about right now.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, I heard about that movie, I still have yet to see it, but I heard a lot of people saying, oh, you know, it was pretty fun. Like, it was pretty good. I thought, you know, they're saying my expectations were quite low, and it was actually not bad.
Well, that's what it is. It's the low expectations.
Sure.
It's a two-star movie. It's a nice little movie that happens to be a huge movie. The one that I like the most is, I love Tron Legacy just because I'm a Tron nerd, but
especially Bruce, right?
Well, yeah, but I really like Lone Ranger, and I had zero expectations for that, and I was like, why are they even making that? Who cares? Why does anybody care other than 70-year-olds about a Lone Ranger movie in 2013 or whenever it was made? Mm-hmm. And that movie has a lot of stuff going on in it and is kind of like Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom goes west. And I just think Gore Verbinski is an endlessly fascinating filmmaker who happens to make these Disney tentpole movies.
Interesting. Well, we may have to give that a poke then, because I have yet to see that movie.
Yeah, it's a considerable movie. It's not something you can just write off. It's quite a movie.
Interesting. Really interesting. Okay, well, is there anything else about Tomorrowland that we have yet to mention that you wanted to?
Just go out and buy those Oreos from your local Girl Scout cookie.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, at least it didn't say McDonald's or, you know, I was like, oh, my God. Like, you got to name brand it. Like,
Yeah. And, you know, I'll give them a pass for all the stuff in the nostalgia shop because that was fun. And that's the stuff that would be in the shop like that. That's but a lot of people are hitting them for that too. But no, it's the Oreos and the Coke and the Chevy. That's the offensive stuff.
Especially the things like, you know, it's a Coke and she's got to be holding it in the classic Coke pose. You know, and things I'm like, okay. Like, I can just imagine Brad Bird going, oh, fuck me. They got this producer right here.
I know. I would love. I'm sure 10 years from now, when Brad Bird brings out the movie that will get him an Oscar nomination, he'll have this honest interview with somebody where he talks about all the shit that went wrong with Tomorrowland. So
yeah, I still think one of the most fascinating people to sit down and to write a book would be Damon Lindelof.
Oh, absolutely. He's a great talker.
He's a guy who's got all the stories. Right?
Yes, he does.
I mean, he's worked everywhere. He's been in Disney forever.
Mm-hmm.
Between ABC and then this film, you know, I mean, he's done plenty of work for Disney.
Yeah, and I would just say if you ever see that Damon Lindelof is going to be on a podcast, to listen to it. There's a great 2.5-hour interview with him on the Kevin Pollak Chat Show that even if you don't like Lost, you will find something fascinating in that interview because he talks and talks and talks, and they're all good stories.
Well, I am looking that up now. So there we go. Okay, well, anything else, Mr. Stangland?
No, I think that'll do it.
Okay, well, after that, if you have any comments, suggestions, or movies that you'd like to hear us talk about specifically for Podshots, you could email us at plainlabelpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow the show over at Twitter under the handle @plainlabelpod, where you could follow me. I'm @EricWilliams79. We also have a Facebook page for the show where you could like it. Just search for Plain Label Podcast. If you wanted to help us out a little bit, you could head over to Amazon.com and search for our wish list. It's full of movies that we want, equipment that we need, and a whole host of other goodies if you're in the giving mood. Just search for the wish list called Plain Label Podcast. And like I said, we probably will have a copy of Tomorrowland on there. you know, because the little one, she quite enjoyed herself. She may want to give it another go. So, if people wanted to find Mr. Stanglin, where would they listen to you, Sean? I mean, you've been on here a bevy of times, but where would they find you if they wanted to hear more from you specifically?
My work Twitter account is at SeanStanglinDH. I work for the Daily Herald in suburban Chicago, where I am a page designer and a columnist and an editor and everything else. And I'm also can be found on Twitter at AngryDisneyNerd, when you can imagine what I talk about there.
Nice. All right. Well, thank you for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another co-host and another film.